Part 4. Asian Echoes. Chapter 10. Taj Mahal, Gateway to the Quranic Vision of Paradise, 1636 CE. A Mughal monument in marble relates to a book of signs through the portal of death. When Arjumand Banu Begum left this world, she took with her the light from the shadow of God, the king of the world, the ruler of Hindustan, her husband, Shah Jahan. Arjumand Banu is also known as Mumtaz Mahal, because in the eyes of her husband, she was just that, Mumtaz Mahal, the choice of the realm. The future emperor had first met her at the Mughal court in Agra. She had come at the invitation of her grandfather, the chief minister to his father, the Emperor Jahangir. The young prince was smitten with her limpid beauty. They were betrothed in 1607 and then married in 1612. Though he had two other wives, he had but one daughter by another wife. Mumtaz Mahal produced 14 children, of whom only 7 survived, but 4 were sons, and 1 was destined to become his father's successor, the Emperor Aurangzeb. Mumtaz Mahal had died in 1631, giving birth to their 14th child. Away on a military campaign, Shah Jahan had not been at her side. 25 years of bliss had vanished, replaced by grief, a hollow in his heart. Intent on honoring in death the woman who had been the center of his life, he vowed to build her a monument that would be a visible, majestic prayer, imploring the Almighty to join his soul with hers until the day of judgment. No expense was spared to construct this monument. Begun in 1632, the Taj Mahal was set in a complex of fountains and trees, gates and mosques, walks and walls that crisscrossed 42 acres on the bank of the Jumna River near the Red Fort guarding the capital city of Agra. It was finished in 1636. For such an intricate monument, 4 years of construction was astonishingly brief. Vast marble blocks had to be quarried, then shaped, the intricate inlay work commissioned, huge gateways and magnificent access routes provided. There were also calligraphic inscriptions. A few were in Persian, but most were in Arabic and drawn from the noble Quran. For the emperor, the meaning of the Taj Mahal is inseparable from a book of signs. Its passages define each and every entrance to the tomb. There are more extensive Quranic citations in the Taj Mahal than in any other Muslim tomb complex. Though most visitors never read these verses, they embody the message of the grieving emperor. The tomb of the deceased queen stands at the end of an exquisite garden. The garden is like other Persian and Indian tomb gardens. It suggests a celestial garden of pleasure and projects the grand design of the Almighty in the world above. Yet only in the Taj Mahal do we find heaven mirrored on earth with words as well as images that flow from the noble Quran. The Taj Mahal replicates heaven, but not any heaven. It is a Muslim heaven, modeled on the imagination of Ibn Arabi. Ibn Arabi never traveled beyond North Africa, Syria, and Arabia, yet his fame resonated throughout Asia. Though Muslim seekers of truth were divided, then as now, about the merit of his teachings, his vision of heaven was never subject to dispute. Heaven was seen as a grand and radiant space. Its centerpiece was the divine throne, borne up by 4 angels. It is the desire of every earthbound form to ascend, to mirror that highest wonder of symmetrical power, the divine throne, and the Taj Mahal fulfills that desire. It both crowns the space in which it is located, and, as a perfect square, each of its corners marked by a minaret, it mirrors the highest abode, the throne of the Almighty. Perfection for Ibn Arabi was never singular or one-dimensional. It always had to be layered, the outside and the inside refracting different tangents of the same divine source. The tomb refracts the power of the divine gaze both outwardly to those who see it as they approach, but also inwardly to those who gaze out from behind the marble filigree windows. The Quranic vision that informs the Taj Mahal is announced at the outset. As one enters through the South Arch Gateway, it is Chapter 89, the dawn or daybreak, that sets the tone for what lies ahead. At the conclusion of its otherworldly vista, the Lord of Life announces, "O soul in repose, return to your Lord, pleased and accepted. Join the company of my servants, enter into my garden." Chapter 89, verse 27 through 30. Expanding the same theme in the North Arch Gateway is a band of three shorter but contiguous chapters. Chapter 93, The Morning Light, Chapter 94, The Expansion, and Chapter 95, The Fig. All echo the hope of the world to come, but perhaps none so vividly as the first, the chapter of the morning light. In the name of God, full of compassion, ever compassionate, by the morning light and by the darkening night, your Lord has not forsaken you. There is no slight. The hereafter is far better for you than this first life. Your Lord will lavish bounties upon you, and you will know delight. Did he not find you an orphan, then give you respite? Find you unaware, then guide you aright? Find you wanting, and then provide? So as for the orphan, do not oppress. So as for the supplicant, do not suppress. And as for the bounties of your Lord, proclaim them. Night, in the second line, may be a metaphor referring to the long period when the Prophet Muhammad had not received revelation prior to the disclosure of this chapter. Now the morning brings with it a further revelation and also a hope that the hereafter will be better than this life. This is because the Lord will lavish his bounties upon Muhammad and, by extension, on all who accept his prophecy. Together they will know delight without end. It is as if the Quranic verse is the foretaste of that delight that will be known to all believers in the world to come. Not only the north-south gateways, but also the tomb as well as the cenotaph of Mumtaz Mahal, all are adorned by Quranic verses. In each case, the verses have been carefully selected. They fit together as seamlessly as the pieces of marble that have inlaid flowers or geometric designs etched on their surfaces. They are among the most familiar verses from the Quran, evoking the glories of paradise time and again. On the tomb itself, one finds beauty enfolding beauty, the scents of the verses matching the ethereal white of the marble and soft pastels and forms of the floral inlays. The arches to the tomb are connected by a continuous expression of Chapter 36, Yasin. Often Yasin is called the heart of the Quran. It is recited in full when someone's dying. As if to emphasize the liturgical practice in stone, the verses of Yasin mark the north arch, since in the cosmology of heaven, it is to the north that the departing soul leaves this world to meet the Lord of Life. These are some of the verses from Yasin that look down from their marble perch. A sign for them is the earth when dead. We revive it and produce grain from it, of which they partake. And we have put orchards of dates and grapes thereon and caused springs to flow on it, that they may eat of its fruit, though they did not make it themselves. So will they not be grateful? Glory to the one who created mates, all of them from what the earth produces and what they don't know. And a sign for them is the night. We end the day with it, and lo, they are steeped in darkness. And the sun runs its course, that is determined by the Almighty, the Omniscient. And for the moon we have determined phases, until it returns to a tiny crescent. The sun is not to overtake the moon, and the night does not outstrip the day, as each travels in its own orbit. So glory to the one who holds sovereignty over all things, and to whom you will be returned. Chapter 36, verse 33 through 40 and 83. Each of the doors set within these massive arches is also marked by a full Quranic chapter on the external gates. Chapter 81, the rolling up on the south. Chapter 82, the splitting on the west. Chapter 84, the bursting open on the north. And Chapter 98, the evidence on the east. All promise the cataclysmic end of life's pleasure and pain. The display of the Quran is then replicated on the interior part of these same tomb gates, with three full chapters, Chapter 67, the Dominion, Chapter 48, the Victory, and Chapter 76, the Human Being, as well as the fragment from another, Chapter 39, the Crowds. This last expresses the need to both acknowledge God's mercy and submit to His will. Say, O my servants who have transgressed against their own souls, do not despair of God's mercy, for God forgives all sins. Indeed, God is the epitome of forgiveness and mercy. And turn to your Lord and submit to Him before the torment comes upon you, after which you will not be helped. Chapter 39, Verse 53 through 54. Quranic script, scrolled across the gates, the arches, and the tomb doors of the Taj Mahal, extends to the cenotaphs. Unusual, if not unprecedented, in Islamic art are the double cenotaphs marking the resting place of Mumtaz Mahal. One is the dummy upper cenotaph. The other is the real lower cenotaph. Both display a profusion of signs from the noble Quran, but perhaps none is so evocative as the reciprocal and symmetric citations found on the lower cenotaph. They consist of the 99 beautiful names of God. The three most common of the beautiful names are given in an inscription on the north end of the cenotaph. He is God, there is no God but He. He knows the unseen and the seen. He is full of compassion, ever compassionate. Chapter 59, verse 22. And then the other 96 beautiful names are divided into six rows of 16 each on the west and east side of the cenotaph. Each name etches the qualities of the divine that have inspired Muslims through the ages, from Ibn Arabi to his Asian successors who crafted the Taj Mahal as the model of heaven. Imprisoned in late life by his son, the emperor Aurangzeb, who feared being denied the throne, Shah Jahan spent his last 7 years gazing at the Taj Mahal from across the Jumna River. Did the grieving, dethroned emperor remember and recite the beautiful names that linked him both to the Divine Beloved and to his earthly beloved? Did he wish to be buried next to Mumtaz Mahal? It seems so, for his was a very quiet, almost secret burial. There was no state funeral, no public ceremony, not even a proper Islamic funeral. Instead, we are told, a few of the eunuchs and others, contrary to the custom of illustrious kings and the practice of his ancestors, placed his coffin early in the morning on a boat and carried it by way of the Jumna River to the Taj Mahal, which he had erected for this purpose. In death, as in life, he shared the same space with the one who, for him, epitomized the beauty of this world, just as his monument to her radiated the splendor of the next.